This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
On May 18th, 2002, the Harris family got a phone call that changed their lives forever. After 6 days of searching for any sign of Jennifer Harris, the hunt was over.
It's a horrible thing to be out there walking up and down the creek bottoms and ditches and things and back roads and knowing that if you find what you're looking for, it's going to be a horrible thing to find.
It was not the outcome anyone had hoped for.
I just remember the look on his face. He looked like he'd seen a ghost.
Join me as we try to discover what happened to Jennifer Harris and who is responsible for her death. From Cold Case Productions, this is Final Days on Earth, Season 2, The Life and Death of Jennifer Harris, Episode 6, The Body. I'm your host, Claire Santamaw. Thanks for listening. It's Saturday, May 18th, 2002. Jennifer has been missing for 6 days, and the search for her has taken over the small town of Bonham, Texas. With each passing day, it seems less likely that Jennifer has just ducked out for some alone time. Investigators are busy sorting through the interview statements and alibis of their two persons of interest, while Jennifer's family still clings to hope.
I remember my dad going out again to look for her and search, and I think I was just at home at Mimi's house with her.
Meanwhile, just a dozen miles away on this Saturday morning, a local fisherman named Eugene Dollar has stationed himself on the banks of the Red River, 2 miles east of the Red River Bridge, where Texas and Oklahoma meet. There, he makes a gruesome discovery in the brush, the floating body of a naked Caucasian female with long red hair. He calls 911. And Oklahoma Highway Patrol officers are dispatched to the scene. The mystery of how Jennifer's life ended is just beginning to unfold. Because Jennifer's body was found in the Red River, Oklahoma authorities took initial possession of it. But upon learning Jennifer's identity and the open missing persons case, they ceded the investigation to Fannin County. Authorities swarmed the scene and cordoned off the area. Investigators now had their hands full with a newly minted death investigation. When Alyssa learned that a body matching Jennifer's description had washed up in the Red River, she got there as fast as she could.
I found out and immediately got in my car and just drove out there to the Red River Bridge.
When she arrived on scene at the Red River, Alyssa could not believe her eyes.
I just kept repeating over and over, this can't be real. They had the place taped off. It's kind of like what you see in a TV show.
Just minutes before, Alyssa had been at her grandmother's house in Bonham, not knowing she was only about 12 miles away from her missing sister.
I just wanted to go see my sister. And everyone was just really holding me back for good reason. But at the time, the first reaction is you just want to go grab them and hug them, you know, and it was awful.
Yeah, that sounds so intense. I can only imagine how difficult that would have been, and just the range of emotions, like you want to see but you don't want to see, and you want to know that it's really her, but then you don't, because it means, you know, life will never be the same.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Only a few weeks earlier, Jennifer had visited Alyssa in Austin for a sister's weekend. They'd gone swimming, shopping, and gotten pedicures. But now, Jennifer's life was over, and those memories were frozen in time.
Well, I couldn't before this ever imagine what that felt like.
Right.
But especially it being someone that's so close to you that you just remember seeing recently and, you know, getting your nails done with.
One of the ways authorities had initially identified Jennifer's body was her curly red hair. Another was the fresh polish and rhinestones still visible on her toes.
I never will forget. She got like this little flower on her toenail.
The once happy memory was now a haunting one.
I don't remember if I even drove back or someone drove me back. To be quite honest, I don't really remember much after that.
Yeah, I mean, I bet it just feels like a blur.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I just, I personally, I remember really questioning just God.
Yeah.
And at the time, across the street from my grandmother, a really nice pastor lived there, young with a family. And I'm sure, you know, he had the best intentions, but he came over to console. And I just remember just being so angry and just saying, I need you to tell me why, mm-hmm. why this happened. You know, I mean, my mom died of brain cancer. So I get that she was sick and, you know, I was angry then and I got over it. But this is different. Someone did this to her, and I need you to tell me why this happened and how could it happen. If there is any good in the world or universe or wherever, you know, this cannot be. And I'm sure he tried to say some really nice things to me, but I just wasn't having it. And I went through a lot of, I guess you could say even transformation, because of the whole ordeal. It was just really challenging.
Jennifer's cousin Susan also remembers exactly where she was when she heard the news.
I teach at Sylvan in the mornings, and when I got out of Sylvan, I had 6 messages on my phone at noon, and I called my dad, and I said, hey, I'm on my way to Bonham. And he said, Susan, don't pull one of your things and go do anything else. Come straight home. And I could hear him talking to the pharmacist, and my dad was using his dad voice. I said, Daddy, what are you doing? He said, I'm getting a sedative for Almond. And I said, for what? And he said, they found Jennifer.
This was what day?
Saturday at noon. And he said, come home now.
As Alyssa and her family tried to absorb the gravity of the situation, authorities went to work to determine what happened.
Now, to be fair, this was a rural sheriff's department.
Former Fannin County investigator, Daryl Parker.
They did not have a ton of training. They didn't have a lot of resources. You can't blame a fish for not knowing how to climb a tree. Her body was actually taken to the medical examiner in Oklahoma City, and they did the medical exam there.
Jennifer's identity was confirmed using her dental records. Upon initial inspection, a few features of Jennifer's lifeless body stood out. For starters, she was completely naked. Not a stitch of clothing was found. Even though her body showed signs of being in the water for an extended period of time, the lack of clothing was not easily explained. There were signs of animal activity on Jennifer's body, which had started to bloat with decomposition, but clothing is not something animals are attracted to. Even if the fast-moving water and rocks in the Red River had torn some of Jennifer's clothing, it seemed nearly impossible that every piece of fabric would have disappeared in just 6 days, the span of time from the last sighting of Jennifer on Mother's Day, May 12th, to the discovery of her body on May 18th. But when a body is found in water with no clear cause of death, authorities have to consider every possible explanation, from suicide to accidental death, and even murder.
Did Jennifer remove all of her clothing before this all happened and she was put into the river or fell into the river?
As we covered in previous episodes, Jennifer was going through an extremely difficult time when she disappeared. At just 28, Jennifer had already had a series of disappointments and failures in her young life. Her mother had died of brain cancer, her marriage to Rob Holman had ended in divorce, and more recently, her massage therapy business and relationship with James Hamilton had fallen apart. In the spring of 2002, Jennifer's family and friends knew she was struggling with her mental health when she moved in with her grandmother. Jennifer had even been diagnosed with depression and was prescribed medication, but refused to take it. All of these circumstances are red flags for a potential suicide, and investigators had to ask the hard question: could Jennifer have ended her own life?
She did leave of her own free will, and that's sort of the indicator that she went with someone that she knew and trusted.
A lot of people talked about in their police interviews that they thought that Jennifer was depressed, that they were worried about her, that she was seeing someone for it, that she'd even been prescribed medication. And so the idea, you know, when she first goes missing, the idea that she could have potentially succumbed to those emotions, you know, I think that idea was very much a real concern for her friends and family.
She was not on top of the world by any means. You know, she was in a place where she was trying to recover.
But for Daryl Parker, the evidence didn't add up to suicide.
If she was planning on committing suicide or harming herself, why would she park her vehicle and just walk off down the road to a bridge 6 or 7 miles away to jump in the river? If she killed herself, where are her clothes? If she killed herself, where's her purse? If she was depressed and she wanted to end it all, why would she lock her vehicle and take all of her personal effects with her? Her keys, her purse, etc. Did Jennifer remove all of her clothing before this all happened and she was put into the river or fell into the river? Well, if that was the case, then we'd expect to find a pile of clothing sitting somewhere. And there was none found.
There are always some unanswered questions in a death investigation, but in the Jennifer Harris case, there was enough evidence left on her body to rule a few things out.
The fact that she was completely naked tells me as an investigator a couple of things. One, that it was a homicide. Someone was there and someone had a role in her death. And two, after the death, they removed her clothing. And what was the purpose for removing her clothing? We don't know. There's no way to determine if a sexual assault occurred before or after death, or if the killer was panicking and he was just trying to think of a way to cover up this crime by tampering with the evidence. We don't know. I suspect it was because they were trying to get rid of evidence. And so they thought that if they stripped the body completely and they got rid of the clothing, that she might disappear in the water, might never be found, and if she ever was found, they wouldn't be able to identify her by her clothing. I think that's probably a spur-of-the-moment decision by a panicked person who didn't know what to do, and that's what they came up with.
On her autopsy, Jennifer's official cause of death was listed as homicidal violence. This is Daryl reading the medical examiner's findings.
The circumstances around her death are extremely unusual and suspicious. There was no evidence of a natural disease process and no toxicological explanation for her death. The possibility of asphyxia or suffocation cannot be excluded. It is felt that this case represents homicidal violence, and the manner of death is regarded to be a homicide.
Here again is Jennifer's sister, Alyssa.
When we got the report back that it said could not rule out asphyxiation, mm-hmm. but there weren't any bullet wounds or, you know, major like stab wounds or anything.
It was frustrating because even though they'd found Jennifer, they were still searching for answers.
But the thing that I don't understand is, doesn't that mean that she could have just been beaten to death?
I think so. The thing that I got from it, and based on just looking at other, you know, autopsy reports and other cases, you know, when a body is found in water, there's so much that washes away. And there's so many changes that that body goes through the longer it's in the water. So what they were able to determine is that it was not natural for Jennifer's body to be found in this condition in the water, for her to be completely stripped naked, and for her not to have any water in her lungs. So it wasn't as if she went swimming, got picked up by a current, you know, got knocked out, you know, and drowned, which could be an accidental death and could be a suicide. But based on the fact that she had no water in her lungs and she had no clothing on, you know, they determined that her death was not natural and that it was murder and that it was a violent death.
Former Fannin County investigator Daryl Parker agrees with the medical examiner that Jennifer was murdered, but he also believes there is still room left to consider drowning as a possible contributor to Jennifer's death.
There wasn't any water found in her lungs. That's what the sheriff has said to me over and over again. Does that mean that she was dead before she was put in the water, or do you think... the evidence shows differently?
Well, that's sort of a myth about, you know, drowning, is that you have water in your lungs. You don't always have water in your lungs. There's a thing called esophageal clenching. You know, the body, it's an autonomous reaction to beginning to drown. When you start to suck in water, a lot of times the body will close the esophagus and it'll clench, and it doesn't unclench until you expire or get out of the water, or you get aid or something like that. So if she was put in the water and her esophagus clenched, then she could still have asphyxiated from that condition. Okay. And then also, when a person dies in the water, how do they die? They die face down because the limbs are heavy, the head is heavy, and they face downward from gravity. That means the body's position is in such a way that the air doesn't naturally come out of the lungs. You know, it's trapped inside the body torso. As long as her esophagus was clenched, and as long as she stayed in that position, head down, limbs down, then gravity would keep the air in the top part of the body and there would be no escape.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I hadn't realized that at all. At least from the crime scene video that I saw, the position that you're describing, you know, of her being face down, arms out, that is how her body was found by the fishermen. So it would indicate potentially, you know, if she did go into the water, possibly still alive, that she would have been in the right position for the air to be trapped in her lungs, like you said.
Yeah,
that's really interesting. Gosh, just when you think, oh, well, we can say for sure that she died before she went in the water because there's no water in her lungs, you find out, you know, not so fast. There's actually
not so fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she could have died. The point is that there's no way to tell. She could have died before she went in the water, or she could have died as a result of being placed in the water. And the fact that she did not have water in her lungs doesn't preclude either one of those.
While the autopsy was thin on certain details, it did provide some very surprising and specific other information.
I know that it stated that her uterus had been removed.
This would be a strange piece of information for any death investigation, but in the Jennifer Harris case, it was downright suspicious.
It crossed my mind that maybe this person actually cut something out because they didn't want anything to be found.
Remember, one of the key questions in Jennifer's missing persons investigation was whether or not she was pregnant. And if she was pregnant, who was the father? As we covered in the last episode, Jennifer had two romantic relationships that overlapped with her alleged pregnancy. Her ex-husband, Rob Holman, and her ex-boyfriend, James Hamilton. I reached out to James and Rob for interviews on this podcast. So far, James has not responded. James, if you're listening, please get in touch. I'd really like to talk to you. Rob, meanwhile, did respond to me, but he declined to be interviewed at this time. Rob, I still hope you'll reconsider going on the record with me. Claire Sanima here, host of Final Days on Earth. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Bonafide. Bonafide provides natural solutions for perfectly natural symptoms. They create non-prescription solutions that treat women's health issues from PMS to menopause and everything in between. New products like Sylvessa, the first comprehensive system designed to restore and protect hair and skin affected by estrogen decline from the inside out. Relelzin provides powerful hormone-free relief from menopausal hot flashes and night sweats, so you can stay cool and dry all day and night. Give Bonafide a try today. No hormones and no prescription required. Real relief without compromise. I'm going to give listeners today a special offer when you subscribe to any product by going to hellobonafide.com/FDOE and use promo code FDOE. That's hellobonafide.com/FDOE and code FDOE to claim your special offer. For the best prices and free shipping, go directly to the hellobonafide.com/FDOE website, so check it out. I thought I knew my dad better than anyone, but one day I heard him talking about the time he worked on a tugboat for the summer. That got me wondering, how many other stories don't I know? That's why I got my dad Storyworth. Storyworth is an online service that helps you and your dad or father figure connect through sharing stories. Every week, Storyworth emails your dad a thought-provoking question of your choice, like, have you ever feared for your life? Or, what's the farthest you've ever traveled? I enjoy reading my dad's answers to those questions, discovering new memories, and learning more about stories I thought I really knew, like the time my dad took his pet rat, LeBlanc, to the movies. After 1 year, Storyworth compiles it all into a beautiful book, including photos, that the whole family can share for generations. I know my son is going to love reading all about his pawpaw. Give all the fathers in your life a meaningful gift you can both cherish for years to come. Storyworth. Right now, for a limited time, you can save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/finaldays. That's storyworth.com/finaldays to save $10 on your first purchase. storyworth.com/finaldays. In interviews with law enforcement back in 2002, both James and Rob admitted to sleeping with Jennifer during the time frame that she claimed to become pregnant. And both men also stated that they weren't trying for children with Jennifer. James, who already had two kids from a previous relationship, said he wasn't interested in having any more. But if James knew that Jennifer was pregnant, he never let on in his interviews with police. Rob Holman, however, was very aware of Jennifer's belief that she was pregnant. According to his own statements to police, Rob said Jennifer told him that she pinpointed their exact sexual encounter that had created the pregnancy.
The night that we had sex, that she was claiming when she got pregnant, I picked her up from Amy's that night.
As we covered in previous episodes, in Rob's interviews back when Jennifer was only considered a missing person, he pressed Fannin County authorities for information on her alleged pregnancy.
Because I never knew, because sometimes through part of the conversation she'd act like it was real straight up, and then part of the time she'd say some stuff, I thought that she wasn't telling the truth about it. So that's why I was asking you if you for sure knew that she was.
And if she wasn't, what kind of difference would that make to you right now?
If she wasn't, Pregnant? I hope she's not.
Either way, she could have hurt you because all she had to do was talk to your girlfriend.
Oh, yeah, but if she wasn't pregnant, it could have.
Right.
You know.
Because she could use times, dates, locations where y'all met. So, you know, she could ruin you any way around.
Right. But there's not a baby involved that'd make things a lot better.
Here again is Daryl Parker.
We can't say anything for sure except that it appears she believes she was pregnant.
And
Rob was notified of it and did not want her to have the child.
Yeah, I remember at one point in the interview, Rob asks investigators, do you know if she's really pregnant? And they say, like, you know, why would it matter? You know, why does that matter? And he was like, well, it'd be a lot better if she wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, during that interview, do you know, meaning presently, do you know that she's pregnant? It's almost as if he believes they might have found her body. Do you know if she's pregnant? It would be better if she wasn't. Yeah, what a statement.
By the time authorities found Jennifer Harris's body, the possibility of learning if she was pregnant and by whom had been completely removed.
So the fact that Jennifer's uterus was missing, you know, that got a lot of attention and it got a lot of people talking about, you know, this pregnancy. She thought she was pregnant and, you know, maybe the person who did this was the father of the child and they removed her uterus to hide the fact that she was pregnant. And, you know, then you couldn't do a DNA test and that sort of thing. And I understand that tendency, but when you see Jennifer's body, first of all, it's a difficult thing to discuss because for someone to reach inside of another person's body and pull out a specific organ, that person would have to have some kind of medical training, know what they were looking for.
In Jennifer's case, the entrance wound for the removal of her uterus was in an unusual location, her backside.
You know, if you were to lay a person's body out and tell another person to remove their uterus, 100 out of 100 people would go through the abdomen, something like that. They wouldn't turn the person over and go through the backside.
Daryl believed there was only one thing that made sense out of Jennifer's so-called missing uterus. And that was animal activity, not human hands.
The defect to Jennifer's body is consistent with animal predation.
And I think you make a lot of good points. It's certainly a sensational detail to have a uterus missing whenever you have questions about a pregnancy and a woman who disappears on Mother's Day. It seems like something you have to talk about. You have to consider. Was this, you know, related to her disappearance, or is this just one of those situations that initially appears to be super important or possibly part of a motive, but whenever you actually peel back the layers and look at it investigatively and with different experts, actually has like a natural explanation that doesn't necessarily implicate any one person.
That's right. And, you know, it's simple to say, oh, her uterus is missing. But the truth is, and I don't have the list in front of me, but there was a lot of tissue damage, a lot of organ damage. You know, her bladder, her large colon, small colon, all of these had damage to them. So it wasn't, oh, somebody went in and took out her uterus. It was a widespread damage.
Sure. But that's the way it got reported, especially.
Right.
In local media, woman found, missing woman found without her uterus, you know, and it really made the leap seem not that illogical. You know, the connection right. was made in the headline and you sort of put the pieces together as you read it and you think, oh, they're telling us that her uterus is missing because the killer must have removed it. You know, it's sort of where your mind goes.
Yeah. And it's, you know, that's the sort of selective information that sends people down the wrong trails.
Absolutely. Because I know that, you know, the idea that someone would know how to, like you said, remove a uterus. I mean, that's an extremely specialized type of procedure. I mean, if that really had been done by human hands, it seems like the list of qualified suspects would be very small.
Very small.
Nevertheless, to fully explore his theory that animal life on the river was responsible for the condition of Jennifer's body, Darryl went a step further.
I did submit the photographs of the medical examiner's examination to the body farm.
Commonly known as the body farm, there is a world-renowned forensic anthropology research facility in San Marcos, Texas. It's where investigators from across the globe send autopsy reports and physical specimens for expert review on how human bodies break down after death in a variety of environments.
In San Marcos, and they deal with a lot of animal predation, buzzards, etc., and ask for their opinion on the wounds, you know, what caused these wounds. And their answer was, this is classic animal predation.
Yeah, I mean, an expert makes all the difference, right? It might look like Greek to you and me, but suddenly you put, a trained expert in front of the same information and it makes perfect sense to them.
Right.
Although she was initially skeptical that Jennifer's missing uterus could be classified as a coincidence, Alyssa has come around to accept the theory of animal activity being responsible for this particular aspect of Jennifer's case.
I don't know that they were considering that if she was found, that that there would be any sort of evidence of a baby either way. I don't know.
Many people dump bodies in rivers and bodies of water to try to hide what they've done. When you have an active river, an active body of water, mm-hmm. that all the animals that live there, the ecosystem, it devours things that are put in its path.
I feel like regardless, that's probably what happened versus someone doing it, because I just think that that would have been a lot messier, and I think that there probably would have been like clothes with blood, and I don't know if that's a coincidence, but I feel like this person knew exactly kind of what to do.
We've spent a lot of time talking about what was missing from Jennifer's body, but it's also worth noting what was left intact. Jennifer's hyoid bone.
So the hyoid bone is a small, pretty fragile bone that goes across the esophagus. And so when someone is strangled and the killer is exerting that thumb pressure on the front of the esophagus, oftentimes the hyoid bone is broken. And so it's sort of a telltale mark for a manual strangulation like that. But not always. Sometimes, you know, the thumbs or the hands are positioned in a way that they're above or below the hyoid bone and it's not broken. And the other thing is that there's an air strangulation or an air choke, and there's also a blood choke, which is where the blood vessels on the side of the neck are compressed and blood doesn't get to the brain and the person dies that way. So the hyoid bone wouldn't be broken in that case either.
Okay, that's super interesting. My first season that I did for Final Days on Earth was about a college wrestler who mm-hmm. was found hanging, and he died. His official cause of death was asphyxiation, and it was ruled a suicide. His hyoid bone was not broken, but he was also involved in a physical altercation, multiple of them actually, but one in particular with the wrestling team captain who put him in a sleeper hold, a choke hold. And so his father, the victim's father, believes that he was potentially choked out in that way and then placed in this noose. Another story for another time, but you're piquing my interest just because the idea of the blood choke versus the air choke is interesting to me. I hadn't heard it described quite that way.
In our military, United States Marine Corps, when they teach hand-to-hand, part of that is a choke from the rear, and it's a blood choke. And it's very effective, and it takes effect very quickly, too.
While authorities couldn't draw any definitive conclusions from the fact that Jennifer's hyoid bone was not broken, Daryl believes another part of Jennifer's body does tell a story.
So when Jennifer was found, her left eye looked relatively normal. Her right eye was this swollen sort of mass. Based on how she was found, face down in the mud, based on the temperature of the water and the days that passed and so on and so forth, I believe that is an indication that she was struck in the right eye. And it would have been a hard, strong blow to cause that kind of swelling. I believe that she was struck, and either that rendered her unconscious or it caused her to start screaming and the person choked her and thought they choked her to death, or did choke her to death and then put her in the water. Maybe she wasn't entirely dead when she was put in the water, and then she drowned. That's the, you know, asphyxiation, suffocation question. Could she have drowned? She could have still been alive, but unconscious when she was placed in the water and then drowned.
With the discovery of Jennifer's body, Daryl Parker's theory was starting to take shape.
Well, I believe that Jennifer Harris went to the hoedown to meet someone that she knew and did meet them there and left with that person in their vehicle, drove to a secluded spot where they got into a very heated argument, and the argument turned physical, and she was rendered unconscious or deceased by strangulation, asphyxiation, and then placed into the water.
You know, it just strikes me, we do have a lot of information in Jennifer's case, surprisingly. But we don't have the key piece of information because there's not like a murder weapon. You know, it's appears to be someone's hands, there's not a smoking gun or a bloody knife to be found.
That's right. That's true. And so you can't really prove, it was these hands and not those hands kind of thing. But, you know, there is a certain thing called evidence, and circumstantial evidence is still evidence. It's just not as strong as direct evidence or forensic evidence. But circumstantial evidence, when you pile it on top of each other, it becomes overwhelming. And I can tell you from working in the field, both as a police investigator and as a private investigator, there are many people in prison on less circumstantial evidence than what we have in this case.
On the next episode of Final Days on Earth, the life and death of Jennifer Harris. Jennifer's family deals with the aftermath of her untimely death.
Got back from the Red River where her body was discovered. And of course, family and friends were coming over to Mimi's. And I believe Dad asked Mimi if she could help create a timeline of Sunday's events that Sunday that she was missing. I just sat and remembered everything and just wrote it all out.
Meanwhile, at Jennifer's funeral, authorities keep a watchful eye.
He said that he had a life in chaplain and Caradone at funerals. Someone who really loved that family cared. You know, that he would find anything to be funny about. To me, it's not, things don't add up.
If you have any information about the unsolved murder of Jennifer Harris, contact the Fannin County Sheriff's Department at 903-583-2143. Final Days on Earth is recorded in Dallas, Texas for Cold Case Productions in partnership with Podcast One. This episode was written and reported by me, Claire Sanimal, and Hillary Wadsworth. Audio production by Matthew Malinger of Podcast One. Original theme music composed and performed by Riley Simmons. Associate producer is April Scales. Editorial consultant is Lucy Scott of lucymedia.com. Executive producers are Sharon Richards and me, Claire Sanimal. Special thanks to Alyssa Harris-Warnick and Daryl Parker for talking to me in this episode.